On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are they the same fiction and nonfiction? Are they slightly different sports? Is there a code switching to go to do one or the other? Or is it just, it's just the same?
It's not the same, except that for me, they are both literary endeavors. But, oh my God, when I'm writing nonfiction, first of all, I try my best not to write it because I know that I'm going to get into so much trouble. So it's like, I'm watching, I'm listening, I'm longing for someone else to say this thing that I want to say so that I don't have to say it. And then, you know, slowly I can feel myself sort of rocking with rage or anger or whatever. And then I stop eating, I stop sleeping. And then it becomes harder not to say it than to just say it, you know. And then I write. That is the nonfiction. And the fiction is the exact opposite. I just take my time. I just take years if I want. I'm completely leisurely and just totally easy in my body when I write it. You know? So they're totally different.
Arundhati Roy is just one of the greatest writers of her generation. Her novels, like The God of Small Things, are beautiful. Her essays, like The Pandemic is a Portal, are powerful and incisive and locate her as an activist and an intellectual warrior. Her work has meant so much to me for so many years. When I was doing college lectures, there was a piece of her work that I would talk about in all of my lectures because it was an amazing breakdown of what modern racism looks like. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about writing. We're going to talk about America. We're going to talk about India. I have been wanting to talk to her for so long. This is such a thrill to talk to Arundhati Roy. You'll get half of this episode for free for the whole thing, which I highly recommend. Sign up at patreon.com/Torre Show. You'll get this whole episode, all of our Wednesday episodes, the whole thing, and our Friday Patreon exclusives. For now, it's the great author, novelist, essayist, warrior, Arundhati Roy on Torre Show. One of your sisters, in a way, Kamala Harris, is now poised to potentially become our next vice president. I'm curious what you make of that.
Well, I think it's difficult for me, to make a lot of it because I don't really know that much about her. But I'm a little kind of wary of this, like the Indian papers are full of, you know, trying to claim her as our own. At the same time, busy putting millions of, Muslims who have lived here for generations off the National Register of Citizens. And so I'm not very comfortable with this claiming of an individual who I don't know that much about, and sort of just because her, you know, grandfather was in India or something, it doesn't make.
Her mother
was from here, but she's always claimed to be American and African American, and that's lovely. I think that's how it should be, you know. So I just hope that whatever it takes, you know, to get Trump out of office, I hope she has it, you know, I hope she has it. And I also hope that we all know, and we've seen it for a long time that, you know, we mustn't end our politics in election campaigns, right. You know, because we want this man out, but that's not going to change the world, you know, because that world is structural and the critique has to be structural, you know, not based on individuals.
So in your book, Azadi, which is so brilliant, you talk about the pandemic, and in America especially, there is such a strong desire to return to normal. And you're one of those people who are like, this is an opportunity to move forward, right? To sort of like almost like a Noah flood moment to like wash away some of the old, horrible, destructive, oppressive things. And I'm not sure there's the political will in America because people are just like, let's just get back to normal. But for so many of us, it's like, no, let's not get back to normal. Let's push forward to something new.
So, you know, there are obviously, when I said, I mean, I said that the pandemic is a portal, and it was a long, but not a very long essay, but an essay in which I spoke about how the coronavirus, whether it was in the US or whether it was in India, was working as a kind of X-ray that sort of exposed the bones of our attitudes, of our injustices, of our inequalities, economic, racist, casteist, classist, also of the plundering of this planet and all of that. And then I said, it's a portal. And there is a way of trying to use this moment to reimagine another way, because unless you first imagine that other way, you're not going to start moving towards it. But two or three things happened, you know, among my friends. I'm like, okay, man, it's not a fucking portal, okay? Because everyone is just like going on about it in this very kind of touchy-feely, hippie way. Oh, it's a portal and all of us are, you know, sort of wearing bell bottoms and platform heels and tripping through it. No, it's a fight, you know? And in that fight, what's happening is that governments are consolidating their positions on everything, using the opportunity of locked down human beings. And what I meant was all of us locked down have the opportunity to think and to reimagine our solidarities, to stop siloizing ourselves in the ways that capitalism has taught us to, you know, because just like, the caste system in India, for example, of course, it's a feudal system. It's a system that began long before capitalism existed, but it's the perfect vehicle for capitalism because it divides everyone, it pits everyone against each other. And that is the same thing that they have tried in the US with race, and to co-opt everything that is a structural critique of an economy, even to co-opt the memory of, Martin Luther King Jr., who, when he made the connections between capitalism, imperialism, racism, Vietnam, he was killed. And then his memory was even too toxic for them. So they started corporatizing it and holding lectures about, you know, defense issues in his name. You know, the list of companies that were involved and are involved in confecting the memory of it. So when I say it's a portal, I mean that, you know, of course I know that data is being consolidated, lines are being hardened in government and corporate minds. But what about us, you know? That's what I meant when I said it's a portal. It's time for us, at least, not to say, let's go back to normality. Because normality is wonderful for certain people, but intolerable for most of the world now.
Well, in what ways would you like to see all of us reshape the world given this opportunity to do so?
Is that a fair question? Well, you know, I think I've spent something like 20 years writing about those ways, you know, so I would be, it would be hard for me to compress it into some little capsule that is easy for audiences to swallow. But I think if I were to speak about it just in conceptual terms, you know, for example, one of the things I wrote for which I took a lot of flack was in 2010, I went into the forests of central India, where there's this guerrilla war unfolding. And the battle lines to people in the television studios are between Maoist terrorists and, you know, the government of India. But I went into the forest and I walked with those comrades for a few weeks. And the real story is that is an indigenous people's homeland. And the government has handed it over to mining corporations, as governments have done over the centuries. And the battle to hold on to that homeland is a bloody one, you know, it's not a Gandhian one. But when I wrote that, I talked about an imagination where you have to redefine what you mean by civilization. What do you mean by progress? What do you mean by happiness? An example that I gave was that in those areas, you have these flat-topped mountains, which are always the sign of the presence of bauxite. Bauxite is the mineral that goes into the making of aluminum, which is like important for every industry, especially the weapons industry, but so many things. So the bauxite was what these corporates were after. But if you speak to the people in that area, they'll tell you that those bauxite mountains, those flat-top bauxite mountains, bauxite is a porous rock. And bauxite is a water tank. When it rains, that bauxite it holds the water in the mountain, and then it irrigates the plains for as far as the eye can see. So for people there, they valued the bauxite when it was in the mountain. But for the corporates, for the economy, for the government, for the military industrial complex, that bauxite was only worth anything outside of the mountain, you know? And I said, the imagination that we have to get to is when we are able to leave the bauxite in the mountain and to know that you take it out and not just the people there, of course, those people will suffer immediately, but even those who take it out will perish eventually. So I would say that, can you leave the bauxite in the mountain literally and metaphorically?
One of the sentences that jumped out at me, you say, the U.S. government perfectly fits its own definition of a rogue state. And it encapsulates the hypocrisy of America, the danger to itself and to the world of current America, the sort of way that America functions almost as like a bratty teenager who you like has a lot of money. So, you know, it can do what it wants to do and it sort of keeps stepping all over other people and getting away with this. And, you know, you think a lot about if America wasn't America, would America want to invade America to like, you guys are in a lot of trouble. You need our help. Yeah. You know, we need to reinstall democracy into America. Just what do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, I have never really lived in America or spent a great deal of time there, but no one needs to, you know, because it's the empire. So we know a lot about it without living there. And while I follow what's going on now. There are such chilling similarities and of course great differences between the US and India. But what I see, which really seems worrying to me, is that, you know, while all of us were initially exhilarated by the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests, I see that Trump and his people are using it to polarize on the other side mm-hmm. right now. And we know that the people, those people are the ones with the guns. They are the ones with the weapons. They are the people who want the NRA to keep going. And so as you're hurtling towards this election, it seems to me that if it's a close call either way, it's almost going to be civil war or something. You know, there is going to be people who, if it's like a clean sweep by one side or the other, then maybe things will be okay. But otherwise, there's going to be an election that is contested in terms of its results. And even if the results are, you know, not contested, they may not be accepted. And I don't know how, it's a bit like how when the anti-citizenship law protests happened here, Muslims who are like 10 or 15% of the population, which is very many millions, were of course supported by many, many non-Muslims who are, against this idea of the Hindu nation and the right-wing nation. But the protests were led by the Muslims and especially by Muslim women. And then the minute Corona happened, it was just completely overturned with these 400 television channels going on about Corona jihad, Muslims are human bombs. And they just undid the solidarity in such ugly ways. So when you see even what happened in the Arab Spring, in the Egyptian Revolution, all of these, you know, great movements, but there was just this judo move and they were turned over. So it's a moment of tension. What is happening in the US, I think all of us are watching with trepidation.
I mean, we're here watching with trepidation. I think we have reached a situation there's a lack of trust of the mechanism of voting on both sides. Yeah. So no matter who wins, there will be 40% of the country that feels like the election wasn't fair. It was, you know, Trump has told his people the election is rigged, and yet we see him trying to rig it. So if he wins, it's because he rigged it.
Exactly.
And if he doesn't, it's because I already told you it was rigged. So then you have a complete loss of faith in the institution of democracy.
Exactly. And here, you know, I wonder whether I would have been happier if I could say that 40% would stand up and fight against the Hindu right, but they will not, you know. So you have a situation where, it's almost like in another sense, democracy has ended because we have what I think of as a one-party democracy, which is an oxymoron, you know. And the other parties have been decimated. This party has all the money, all the data. It has the cunning with which to win elections, but it hasn't got the brains with which to run this continent. So yesterday's papers, minus 23.9 is the GDP.
When you write about Trump's visit to India, I can feel the disgust in your pen. I can feel the anger. And yet he seemed to only come because a million people would be there to listen to him and cheer for him. And
he came at the time when the coronavirus was was making inroads, you know, and this government did nothing because they wanted, you know, thousands of people to come. And so in the middle of this pandemic, you had these tens of thousands or million or whatever the people were in assembled to listen to him in Gujarat. And then Gujarat became a coronavirus mega hotspot. But of course, they were blaming the Muslims for spreading it, you know? Yeah.
I mean, you just...
Then Trump told us that we play cricket and, you know, he told us all the festivals that we celebrate. And I was like, thank you.
I mean, just his inability to see other people's humanity is extraordinary.
Yeah, but it's, you know, I mean, in India, I can't say that, you know, we are any more human than anyone else because as you read, you know, like while he was here in Delhi, people were being beaten to death on the streets. Young Muslim men who were dying were being forced to sing the national anthem. And, you know, now there are so many reports coming out about how people taunted them and women, you know, taking off their pants and saying, "You want Azadi, here it is." Mm. And, you know, so the lack of humanity here, you know, people are being lynched and those videos are being put up on YouTube and liked and, you know, supported. So I think, you know, I can't really say that there's any moral superiority here.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colin McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
I mean, you know, your ideas are really powerful, and the ways that you express them are quite often really beautiful or really sharp or, you know, and I find myself getting equally excited about your fiction and your nonfiction. There's a really interesting discussion within the book about different people in the world telling you, hey, you need to focus on your fiction, and others saying, hey, nonfiction is what's important. You know, this other stuff is just playtime, and you resolve it. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, you stake at this ground where you're like, I need both things to be a whole person and a whole thinker in the world. And so many of us think of ourselves mastering one side or the other, but you see them as two parts of the whole you.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was very young, I used to always think, why does everyone have to have a profession? You know, it seemed like some kind of odd way of growing to me, you know, because I studied architecture and urban planning. I worked in cinema. Then I wrote a novel. But for me, there wasn't any great difference in all of these things, because I was constantly looking at myself as a person who lives in this world, who's trying to understand it and express it with every kind of tool that I might have, you know, whether it's in a screenplay, whether it's in a novel, whether it's in a nonfiction essay, whatever, it doesn't matter. What is the best way of doing it, you know? And at the time when The God of Small Things came out, you know, at that time, English publishing in India was really, you know, you just had this one publisher, it was Penguin, but it was such a small outfit and all the books were orange and all the text was crooked. And I was like, no, thanks. You know, I can't do this because I also am a student of design. But when that book came out and, you know, obviously it won this big prize, and I was so terrified of the way in which people wanted to shape me, corporatize me, replicate me, make me replicate myself. You know, fame is a form of domestication that's worse than marriage. It's like, please, you know, just let me be. Let me make my mistakes. Let me write a worst seller, whatever. But I was being celebrated, and for many reasons, you know, India was just coming into its own as this free market economy. And then they did these nuclear tests, and the Hindu right came to power like within months. And I was very much a part of that, you know, showpiece. And I had to step off the pedestal and say, sorry, but it ain't me, babe, you know? So then it went into this whole other realm. And to me as a writer, nothing do I crave more than understanding, you know? Because all of us are thrown these bones which we're supposed to just chew, like whether it's from the resistance, whether it's from the oppressors, whether it's from our parents, you know, there's this pressure for you to just accept and inhabit this little shape that you're given. But as a writer, to understand, what does a big dam do? How does this public language change? What goes on in the forest with the comrades and half of their army are women, you know, fighting? Why are they fighting? So it's just like the curiosity that took me into all these places and deepened my understanding. And therefore, all of it is a part of me, you know, all of it. And I don't have this desire to write, you know, like 500 books and win 79 prizes. It's not that. It's just, how can you live while you're alive, you know? How can you really make texture from stories?
Are they the same, fiction and nonfiction? Are they slightly different sports? Is there a code switching to go to do one or the other, or is it just, it's just the same? As a writer, as a stylist, as a person who's trying to express.
No, it's not the same, except that for me, they are both literary endeavors. But, oh my God, when I'm writing nonfiction, and this is not true for every writer of nonfiction, the kind of nonfiction I write, I'm talking about. It's like, I try my best not to write it because I know that I'm going to get into so much trouble. So it's like, I'm watching, I'm listening, I'm longing for someone else to say this thing that I want to say so that I don't have to say it. And then, you know, slowly I can feel myself sort of rocking with rage or anger or whatever. And then I stop eating, I stop sleeping. And then it becomes harder not to say it than to just say it, you know. And then I write. That is the nonfiction. And the fiction is the exact opposite. I just take my time. I just take years if I want. I'm completely leisurely and just totally easy in my body when I write it. You know? So they're totally different.
And with fiction, you're just trying to tell a story. It's not about, I have an idea that I want you to understand. Just like, here's a beautiful story. Here's a great character.
It's more than that, I think. It's also very experimental. You know, like for me, the Ministry of Utmost Happiness, it was like, can a novel be a city? You know, can it be as complicated as a city? Can it be broken and redesigned? Can we make the reader go down these little paths and sit and smoke with the cobbler and say, hey, brother, where have you come from? And, you know, what's your story? And can we just stop saying this is the cobbler, but can he have a name? And can I not be scared of the reader's confusions? Because you got to live in the city. You got to get lost. You got to be a bit scared. You can't just drive down the highways. So it was like, as a person who studied architecture, it was very important for me, the structure of that book. You know, can it be like sort of complicated and yet designed, you know? And so the form itself was important. And then telling a story, it's not even like I know the story when I start writing it, but the characters, I need to know them so well that I can tell you that they are still sitting around, you know, behind the screen and sort of saying, what the hell are you saying about us? So I like the fact that I keep getting letters from prisons asking about the characters in Utmost Happiness. And, you know, someone asked me, like, now today, you know, where do we stand when we fight? And I said, because Utmost Happiness, eventually it's about graveyards. And that graveyard in Delhi where Anjum runs a guest house where each room has a tomb. And, you know, the people that live in that guest house, that die in that guest house, that are buried in that guest house, in that graveyard, that are married in that graveyard, to me, that's...
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
The springboard of where we need to stage our fight from, because we are in a kind of graveyard now. You know, the oceans are full of masks and, you know, everything's running out. And here Anjum has her little garden and she's, you know, preparing. She has a swimming pool without any water that she's very proud of because, you know, rich people have swimming pools with water, but at least we have a swimming pool without water, you know. So,
before I did my first novel, I did my own little sort of urban planning study and like read Jane Jacobs just to try to, because I thought it might inform, and I think it did inform what I was trying to do in a valuable way, and like Rem Koolhaas's work. And I wonder the value of studying urban planning and the value of studying architecture for a writer, and how you've been able to bring the things that you learned from those disciplines into your fiction and your nonfiction.
Well, you know, I can't imagine anything that I would have liked to study more than architecture in order to be a writer. But the good thing was that it was a very anarchic education because, you know, it was, I don't know, I learned as much outside the classroom, as much in rather crazy arguments with my professors. You know, I had left home when I was 17, so I was living in some really peculiar place. And, you know, so coming to know the city from the point of view of someone who really had no protection in the city and who really had not very much respect for what was being formally taught as the way to build or design, you know. So all of it really mattered to me. And in fact, the first screenplay that I wrote was for a feature film about students in architecture school, you know, where all the students are just like, people have failed their fifth year four times and are now selling chickens and rabbits from their room and everyone is stoned. And, you know, so the whole education was pretty bizarre. But when I came to my final year, I said to my professors that I don't really want to design a building for my thesis. I want to do a thesis on the post-colonial city of Delhi. How did it come to be what it is? What it does to those who live in it? How all the institutions that urban planning teaches you, you know, whether it's land use or sewage or whatever it is, excludes the poor. It excludes a majority of the citizens, and people are shitting on the sewage system, as I said in my thesis, and they were not amused. I said they're shitting on top of the sewage system. So in fact, in Utmost Happiness, there's a moment where one of the characters is looking out of her window at dawn and she sees this group of women who are, you know, road workers. And they're standing around this open manhole, you know, with their pickaxes and all that. And all of them are protecting this little boy who's basically shitting straight into the manhole. Like, it's, you know, so I think he's making this direct deposit, and maybe it's their first foothold in the city, because even the sewage system was not for them, you know. They have nothing in the city. So to me, these kinds of things, I mean, the whole of Utmost Happiness is really about the city and you know, the renovation of it, the old city of Delhi, the new city, the aspirations of being the superpower. So it's very much a novel that could only have come out of this this fascination for cities. Although the God of Small Things, of course, comes from having never been to a city. I mean, when I grew up in that little village, so I remember when I came to Delhi by train, I'd never been to a big city before, and I had no idea of the scale. So I went to an auto rickshaw, you know, one of those three-wheelers or cabs or something, and I said, "Can you take me to Mrs. Joseph's house?" Like, what? Who the fuck is that? I said, "My mother's sister." So she's like, "No, this is Delhi, you know, not some village."
Let me ask something dangerous, and feel free to tell me, like, you know, to bugger off. Can you tell us anything about the next novel?
Oh, I wish, but I haven't. You know, I am fighting this kind of pressure to start doing something, because I'm trying to understand what's going on, right? I mean, we can't act as if nothing's going on. I mean, that it's just the same, and we'll. I think I'm just still trying to understand, and I'm feeling extremely trapped because although I haven't properly been locked down, you know, I had a media card and I have been writing stuff and all that, but I'm not free to travel, to go to the places that I would like to go and listen and talk and think and see, you know. And so I'm feeling very thwarted right now, very thwarted. So, you know, I'm waiting to be let out.
For more from me and Arundhati, join us over at patreon.com/Touré Show. Thanks so much to Arundhati for a great interview. And thanks to you for listening. And thank you to our super producers, Britt, Marcus Harkis, Noel, Sam Montes, Jason Reynolds, Gerville Calais, Michelle, Brenda Cox, Kathy F., and Dr. Kina Murphy. Touré Show gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Touré and on Instagram at Touré Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/Touré Show. And check out my newsletter, Black Minds Matter. Go to blackmindsmatter.substack.com. Touré Show is written by me, Touré, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean, and we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests, because the man can't shut us down.